Identification. This is program 2 in the Heritage series, subtitled Little Desert, tape 1 of 2, recorded Sydney, Friday the 25th of January, 1971. End of identification.
It's been known as the Little Desert as long as I know, but it's misnamed. There's been people come along here. One came through it and then wanted to know where the Little Desert was. And they said, you've come through it. And they expected to see sand dunes, Sahara Desert, similar to the Sahara Desert and sand dunes. However, it's misnamed. When you come to think of it, there's about 600 different varieties of plants lying there. So, God, it's not a no desert. I always call it the scrub. I don't call it the desert.
If you go west from the Wimmera River, north from Natimuk or Garuk, south from Dimboola, Nil or Caniva, you're in Victoria's Little Desert. As the farmer said, it's scrub country. A pocket of it growing on prehistoric coastal dunes, but now surrounded by farmlands. For most of our history, it's just been there, crown land occasionally leased for grazing. But in 1969, the graders went in and the lot signs went up. Clearing for development seemed to have begun.
I was approached to buy. They wanted to buy this little area of 20 acres that I known now as Broughton's Waterhole. They said that if it came into one of the blocks that they were surveyed block, it would be a real mix-up. They'd have to have a road into it, and it'd be a real mix-up. Prior to this, I'd offered it to the school as a picnic ground. The school hadn't decided where they wanted. I explained to these people that I'd offered it to the school, and until they turned it down, I couldn't do business. He pestered the life out of me, and he said, you know, Williams, he said, you're retarding progress. I said, if that's the attitude you take, you'll never get it. And that's what got my back up, and I'm pleased now that the attitude we took. Well, then, the locals, they reckon we were retarding progress. Alec Hicks, Avalon Coots and myself, they called us the three blind mice. We couldn't see any further than our nose. Well, that didn't disturb us at all. We really appreciated it. Now we refer to ourselves as the three blind mice. It's a compliment.
Oh, well, it's debatable because I know in my own personal fact it can be cleared, and I've cleared some, but it can be cleared, but why clear it now? Why not leave it till it's practical when they want land to do it, and it's not now because nobody wants the produce you're growing on it.
I find a lot of enjoyment going out there, looking at the flora, not only on my own, but with now that it has become publicised, going out with the numerous visitors, men like Dr. Melville, for instance, from England, for instance, together with Mr. Williams and Mr. Coates, we enjoy taking them out.
The three blind mice of Caniva, three local farmers who have adopted the desert and become its spokesmen. And in their battered Land Rover, they've initiated many a distinguished naturalist to the ways of the scrub.
Well, I was never interested in it. As a young fellow, I grew up in the bush and not concerned about conservation at all. Until what brought it to my mind was back in, about 20 years ago, there was a Dr. Melville from the Kew Gardens in London, came out. I had to take him out along with Alec Hicks and take him out for the scrub. Well, we got in the scrub about 10 yards. He said, pull up. I stopped and he got out, and I suppose we spent 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour there. Went on. I never changed gears. He went on about another 10 yards, pull up. And he again got out staring into space like a Queensland bullet. Luckily he got on, I enticed him to get into a Land Rover and went about another, never changed gears, and he found some banks there, honeysuckle I called it. He pulled up, which he did, and he got out and he spent no end of time, and by this time I was getting exasperated and I said, you better stir yourselves up, you fellas, otherwise we'll never get out there. And he looked at me, he said, look, P.L., by this time he's calling me P.L., look, P.L., he said, this is the first time I've seen these plants and this beautiful trees grown in our native state. We've got most of these in England, but you ought to see them alongside of these. And he said, are you going to deny me of that? He said, for goodness sake, yeah, bear with me and have a bit of patience. I shut up then. But that was my, and from then on, I got quite interested, you see.
On the right here, we have the silky tea tree, Leptospermum mesonoides. In the desert, we have quite a rare mouse, and for its environment, the mouse has to have silky tea tree. The pink one we see is the common fringe myrtle, that is Calotrix tetragona, quite a pretty thing. Colour varies quite a lot to pink, reds, and some places there are even white forms of it. Over further we see a yellow one, that is the Stackhousia. And another one over here too is a heath, the Daphne heath, Brachyloma daphnoides. This one is a milkwort. The Bankers, Banksias, or some people call them honeysuckles. There's two species here in the little desert, Banksia marginata and Banksia ornata. We have sedges.
This is a Malahan's nest or Lowen's nest. Quite a few of them in here, but not very many up this end, or else we haven't found them. There's a lot here we haven't found.
They have an incubation period about 61 days, and the little fellows, when they hatch, they climb to the top, and as soon as they just dry themselves and they run off, they're all ready to go. The Lowen lays a very large egg for its size, and when the young are born, well, they are born at the very advanced stage of development. But, when you go down to see Mr. Keith Akeley, he has some there, and he's made quite a study of the Lowen, and he can perhaps tell you a lot more about it than what we can.
By 1955, clearing of land on the northern edge of the desert had reduced the population of the Malahan, or Lowen, as the Aborigines called it, to a dangerously low level. Fortunately, the people of Kayata asked for and received approval to establish a sanctuary. The local storekeeper, Keith Hately, became warden.
On the mound, but you can see he's opened the mound there to try and increase the temperature, let the sun onto the mound, you see, so to increase the temperature in the egg chamber there. Well, now he's gone away for a while, but he'll be back shortly. Once that becomes heated again, now we'll probably gradually rebuild the hotted sand back over the mound, you see. So to keep that temperature around about 94 degrees, this bird's working this temperature, but he should be here in a few moments anyhow. I think if we just wait a little while, we'll probably see him.
All right, good.
This mound here has been known for 18 years, and at the commencement, it's been a big depression scraped out in the ground there, so it's mainly sand. A big depression about 4 foot deep and about 3 foot 6 in diameter at the beginning. Now that was completely filled with debris, scratched from all around a radius of all up to over 100 feet around. And then the material that had been taken out was used to cover that debris, therefore forming a mound. And this mound now, for instance, now, of course, is usually around about 4 foot 6 to 4 foot 8 high, which means the eggs, even the last egg laid, is quite often 3 feet 6 from the top of the mound.
What weight of materials on top of the eggs?
Well, this one here is approximately 13 ton. But some mounds, there is a couple of mounds here that estimated 24 ton. A tremendous thing, admittedly. Here's Romeo now. Look at him. Have a look at him.
Isn't he a beauty?
Yes. Hi, Romeo. Come on, boy. There you are. Romeo. Come on. Romeo. Now, there you are. You seen a prettier bird than that? Boy. Now, there you are. It's the size of a very small fowl, isn't it? It wouldn't be a large fowl by any means. And he's 18 years of age. Romeo. Come on, boy. Come on. Come on. It's not very often you see a mellie fowl as tame as that bloke, is it? Romeo, come on. There you are, boy. Come on. This one's Romeo. The female is Juliet. Now, she may come in a moment. And very hard to tell the difference as far as colour goes. But you'll notice a difference in the head. And in fact, in this case, though, you can tell the difference in the body shape. But a lot of them you can't. But Julie, a very plump bird. Romeo seems to be, as if he built for speed, doesn't he? But he's a beautiful thing. Have a look here, Romeo, old boy. Come on. Hold your head up. That's a shot. Good boy. Lovely.
Yeah, he's marvellous.
Prior to the drought, there was a pair of 50 acres actually breeding in here, which is really phenomenal. Because when you get into normal whipstick mallee type of country, we probably only average a pair to perhaps a square mile, over 600 acres, you see. But there was terrific mortality, of course, then, because the country was only carrying the amount of birds that, according to the food that was available. And as the food became scarce, well, of course, the birds had to thin out a little too. But nature will look after that, and I think two or three good seasons now and be back to, normal population or perhaps high density for a while again.
Here in the rubble and the sand, this monument by thee was planned. Great was the love that in thee hid, O builder of the pyramid. By no delirious king compelled, but by the mother heart upheld, little of pain or toil thou recked, brave builder, eager architect. This and no other was thy shrine, this monument to birth was thine. Great was the love within thee hid, O builder of the pyramid.
Six or seven a year ago.
This is the what? What's the name of it?
Westringer cassifolia.
Is that what?
Come here. It was 1965 when we first found it. That was in an area southeast of Broughton, of Chinaman's Flat. Since then, we've found it north and south of Chinaman's Flat, and also here where we are now, which is about 100 yards west of Broughton's waterhole. One of the rare plants of the world. Apart from the Little Desert, the only locality where it can be found growing is in the Whipstick Mallee at Bendigo.
And you own this place. You're one of the few people who own some of these plants.
Apparently.
The only man in the world that owns any of it.
They tell me I'm the only man in the world that owns it, some of it, but it's a rare plant, but I don't know much about it all the same. Alec is more conversant with it.
What else is round here, Alec?
Yes, the yellow gums and the acacias, quite a number of acacias here. There's another bit of pea here too, Dave, which is Mr. Foley, the broom bit of pea. is growing around here too. Not a very common plant in the Little Desert. There's a hakea there, a wrinkled hakea, the hakea rugosa, also the other hakea, hakea flexilis, and one that's now quite, is flowering now, is the Melaleuca wilsonii, the crimson honey myrtle. I think it's most colourful here during the latter part of August and September when all the acacias are in flower.
There's not so many just in here, but in the tall timber on the southern side, there's a you'll find quite a few eagles, the big wedge-tailed eagle nest. We've had them, and you can get them as tame as anything. We've had them as pets. In fact, the last eagle that we had, he took a set on women. I've got little grandchildren, and we had to get rid of him. Otherwise, and he's down at the Melbourne Zoo, otherwise he would have attacked them. He'd attack women, but he wouldn't attack anyone else.
There's an eagle's nest there, but just it's a bit hard to say how old it's been. And you can see how long they'd take to build them by the sticks, that the load of the trips they had to do it. But they're pretty big sticks. And I don't think they've nested in it this year. There's no bones or anything lying around, so I think it'd be mould.
Now we're here in this box flat, and this is a place where it may be possible to find possums or gliders. Being black box trees, they're hollow, and that's the type of tree that these possums like. As we walk along, we look around and have a look at the trunk or the limbs and see if we can see any scratch marks on them. And if we do, well, it's a possibility then there's a possum up that tree in the hollow, perhaps. Hmm.
You can see that's pretty well worn there, the possums. Mm. But you generally find the droppings to make sure.
Yes, yeah, a bird flying around here. That's a cuckoo, possibly the pallid cuckoo. Cuckoos are well known to everybody. They're the ones that lay their eggs in somebody else's nest. The Little Desert's been studied by quite a number of bird enthusiasts. Mr. Middleton at the Whale Nursery, he has made quite a study of the birds here in the Little Desert. And also Mr. Claude Austin comes up from Coleraine, and he's been out with us on numerous occasions studying and looking at the birds here.
The Little Desert, of course, is the southern boundary of quite a number of birds. The scrub robin is one interesting terrestrial and insectivorous bird. The Amatornis striatus, the striped grass wren, we haven't actually found there yet, but I think it's probably its southern extension. Such things as the chestnut-tailed thornbill, the red-tailed thornbill. The possibility, and it's a distinct possibility now because somebody thinks they've found it, of the western whipbird, which is one of Australia's much more interesting birds, a bird that probably existed right across the southern part of Australia a few thousand years ago, but has now got into pockets in parts of Australia, Western Australia, a pocket down in the Eyre Peninsula in South Australia, and now more recently discovered in the Big Desert and possibly in the Little Desert. These are all birds on the boundary of their range, and scientifically, of course, anything on the boundary of its range is of great interest, because why, as science will discover in the future, why does it live there and no further? Why does it live for hundreds of miles east or west or north or south, but no further than its particular range? And the Little Desert is the bottom end of the range, the southern end of the range of a great many species of birds. It has, of course, the Little Desert has a terrific number of flowers, of shrubs and flowers flowering in it, and those flowers, of course, have pollen. They attract insects, and therefore they attract birds. And the Little Desert, in a good time, when the flowers are flowering well, is possibly contains the thickest population of birds per acre of any part, I think, of Victoria.
In the Little Desert, I've recorded about 150 species of birds since I've been wandering around out there. About 30 of these are migratory species, and quite a number of other ones aren't particularly common, although you wouldn't necessarily find them there all the time, but there are some very interesting species that do live in the Little Desert and only occur in very specialised habitats in the Little Desert. An example of one of these is the dark thornbill, and another is the Rufous field wren. These are two small birds which are confined to the dwarf scrub areas in the Little Desert. You don't find them in any other vegetation association. And this type of vegetation is absolutely vital for their survival. Some of the habitats around and near the Little Desert have been whittled away over the years, and some of the bird species have suffered accordingly. In these semi-arid areas, in fact, the more arid the area becomes, the greater area that is required for these birds and animals to survive. It was very marked during the 1967 drought that the bird populations in the Little Desert dwindled to a very low figure. Quite a lot of us, ornithological friends of mine, spent quite a bit of time out in the Little Desert during this time. And we were appalled, really, at the lack of birds. Now, there was only one thing that happened to these birds. The populations must have just been whittled down because of the extremely dry conditions. The birds just weren't there. So it points to the fact that you've got to have big areas. Small areas wouldn't be just viable for these animals to survive.
Chinaman's flat. Alec knows really the history. He's gone into it, and we have to thank him for that part. Alec, will you explain now the history of it?
Yes, this is the spot where, back in 1892, a Chinaman, his name was Charlie R. Carr, died whilst trying to walk from Newell to Groat. He became lost, and but at that time there was no water here, and he just died of thirst. According to our folklore, this place had been known as Chinaman's Flat for many years, but nobody knew the name of the Chinaman, nor did they know when he became lost here. The gold escort actually passed through this district. The local historical society were very interested in it. And a lot of the research and work that has been done by Mr. Blake. He is the president of the Royal Historical Society of Victoria.
We had a request from an old gentleman who in Nil, who had some kind of folk story about a gold coach crossing the Wimmera. Now, we investigated in the various libraries of Australia, finally found some old maps and old documents, but having found these and having discovered that what the new man was talking about was a gold escort from Castlemaine of Adelaide, we still couldn't equate the maps with the present-day maps. And to do this satisfactorily, we had to go out with four-wheel drive vehicles and try to pick up the original point where the Gold escort route across the South Australian border near Surbiston, and then try to follow the track on compass bearings from the old maps in a direction running approximately southeast. Now, we did this in 1962, a party of us with two four-wheel drive vehicles, and we found what was virtually a hollow way that had been beaten down by the tens of thousands of men and women who had walked or driven drays or wagons across Little Desert to get to the Victorian goldfields. And along this track, in a period of 2 years, 52-53, some 18 escorts of gold travelled and took back to Adelaide from Castlemaine and Bendigo, gold valued in those days at over £1 million. Here and there we came across clay pans and soaks. We also found a place where the horses had been tethered. The remains of the rails were still there. We dug out one soak and found the timbering of the well, because the wells were sunk for watering the horses. And at the old Wyndham sheep station, we located the site of a poisoned well where a bushranger had poisoned the water to try to stop the horses and thereby have a chance to rob the escort. Well, this didn't come off because the escort commander carried a small dog, which he always gave the first drink of water to. Another story that is associated with Little Desert, which I investigated, was the story of Jane Duff. Jane Duff was born Jane Cooper in Horsham in 1857, but this story relates to 1864. Her father was working on Spring Hill Station, which is approximately southwest of Horsham, where a tongue of Little Desert comes down towards the Horsham-Gurak Road. She had two brothers, and Isaac and Frank. Isaac was slightly older than her, and they were sent out by their mother to collect some broom to sweep the floor of the hut they lived in. And in the desert country, they lost their way, and for 9 days and 8 nights, the three little children were lost in the desert. At that time, Jane was about 7 and a half. The amazing thing is that she looked after her two brothers all that time. At night time, she'd take her dress off and put it over Frank, who was only a little toddler. She found berries for them to eat. And in the meantime, of course, the father and mother and the local squatter, Wilson, were quite frantic in their searching for the children. They finally sent a man on horseback across the desert to Mount Elgin Station, where he obtained two Aboriginals, and these two men came down and they located the children asleep under a tree and brought them back safely. The story so stirred everybody that Jane was sent a special piece of sculpture from England. There was a poem written about her, there were booklets written about her, and when she married and retired to live in Horsham in rather poor circumstances, the school children of Victoria raised a fund to help Jane Duff as she grew older. She was assisted right till the end with the money given by children to mark the amazing heroism of a small girl of 7 and a half.
This is what they call the wild dog sting. It's east of the Dortons waterhole, about 3/4 of a mile. It's the water's in later on in the year, in the summertime, it gets very brackish, but at the present time, it's not too bad. The kangaroos and emus drink here. We've never known this to be dry. Never known this all that time. And the vegetation, I'll hand you to Alec. He can tell you about the vegetation in it.
Yes, in growing in this biodog spring is a seagrass, Ruppia maritima. It's most unusual to find this growing up here in the little desert. But water being salty, being brackish, well, that's where it will grow. It's seagrass wouldn't grow in fresh water. Around two, growing here in the sand, is a plant called mud trees, Kunzea permifera. It's a natural soil binder. It's an interesting plant too, in that the berries on it, the blackfellas used to eat it.
Seagrass, it fruits down under the water level and sends these little tendrils up to fertilise the fruit. And the fertiliser down there, and the emus come along, but this year there's hardly an emu came here. It's only a clutch here and the young ones, but this year it's missed out on it. And they're eating this fruit of the seagrass.
The biggest flock of emus that I have seen here, there's 41. There could have been more, but we did count 41. I've seen up to a mob of 20 or 30 kangaroos in one mob, but that's out here. If you're in the, they come into the open country, the land adjoining this scrub, then you might see more there, but in their natural state, I've seen up to 20 many a time here.
Well, I've always been nature, all my life. I've always been keen on it, but I didn't. I thought I knew what was here, but I wouldn't believe that these little pygmy possums were here. You can't. Little things about the size of a mouse living here and not knowing they were here. But they're here, all right. Mr. Williams, we found five in a nest down here. And
over by Stan's camp, up further over here in the east, we found four pygmy possums and we took them home, put them in a glass jar about 18 inches high. Next morning they were disappeared. We searched, we found them. And that was the first time anyone knew that they had suction pads and can climb any glass or anywhere, just like flies. They're about the size of a house mouse. Very prominent ears, big eyes. And you can see a possum in a little curly tail. Oh, pretty little things. Clive Crouch will show you those tomorrow.
They're unique because it's only found in the Mallee areas. This is known as the southwestern pygmy possum. In Gippsland, they have another one there which is a little bit larger than this and quite common. But these are not at all common. They may be found in hollow trees or in old bird's nests. This one was found in a disused bird's nest in the little desert. The little desert is only about 7 or 8 miles south of Caniva, and so much of my time was spent there, particularly my early youth, riding pushbike out there at weekends to look at birds or reptiles or mammals. And for about the past 5 years, I've been studying a native mouse, which is found there, a small native rodent known as the silky desert mouse. The small bluish-grey mouse, a little bit larger than the introduced mouse. They're a nocturnal creature, and so consequently they have large ears and large eyes. They also have a very long white tail, which serves to distinguish them from the introduced mouse. If there's no further development of the little desert, the animals and bird life, the reptile life and the mammals should be reasonably safe. Their greatest threat, apart from development, is from bushfires, which seem to be fairly prevalent in the little desert. Quite a few farmers claim that these fires are started by lightning, but I don't think that's entirely true. It'd be more likely that the farmers who have large areas of the little desert or who have had large areas of the little desert on grazing leases, when they're a little bit short of food for their sheep, will light up the desert and then put their sheep in on the green shoots as it regenerates. This has been the custom of the farmers for perhaps the last 50 years. The native animals would have to compete with this naturally, but probably there's been more fires in the desert in the last 50 years than there has been in perhaps the 2,000 years preceding this. This area is fairly dry. There's not much apart from the little desert
which would be of interest to anybody. We did have quite a good boating area at Lake Hindmarsh, but that's gone dry now. It's over 100 miles to the nearest mountains. It's over 100 miles to the nearest part of our coastline, around 230 miles to Melbourne and about 240 miles to Adelaide. And so we're fairly well isolated, but to me this just doesn't matter because the little desert holds so much attraction to me or for me. And I just find it such an interesting area that I'm content to stay here and try and learn, unfold some more of the mysteries of the little desert. But unless a person has an interest in perhaps wildlife or just the uniqueness of the area, they probably wouldn't see any beauty in it.
Oh, 'twas a poor country. In autumn it was bare. The only green was the cutting grass, and the sheep found little there. Oh, the thin wheat and the brown oats were never 2 foot high. But down in the poor country, no pauper was I. My wealth, it was the glow that lives forever in the young. 'Twas on the brown water, in the green leaves it hung. The blue cranes fed their young all day, how far in a tall tree. And the poor, poor country made no pauper of me. I waded out to the swan's nest. At night I heard them sing. I stood amazed at the pelican and crowned him for a king. I saw the black duck in the reeds and the spoonbill on the sky. And in that poor country no pauper was I. The mountain ducks down in the dark made many a hollow sound. I saw in sleep the bunyip creep from the waters underground. I found the plover's island home, and they fought right valiantly. Poor was the country, but it made no pauper of me. The new year came with heat and thirst, and the little lakes were low. The blue cranes were my nearest friends, and I mourned to see them go. I watched their wings so long until I only saw the sky. Down in that poor country, no pauper was I.
As a small boy, John Shaw Nielsen came across with his father. He took up a selection at Minamay, just south of Little Desert. Nielsen went to school at Minamay for about 18 months. He had some other education before that, but his total would be about 3 years. The selection at Minamay was a failure, and so the father decided they would move out across Little Desert and that they would go to Nil. Now, they made the journey by covered wagon. Both the father and his stepbrother with his family, plus a cart, plus one cow, trekked across the little desert, across the sand dunes, to a place called Dow Well, which is just out of Nil, and here they settled. Nielsen, living on the edge of the desert, and as a small boy, roaming through that country and working as a bush labourer in that country, came to know it very well. And from this he drew the inspiration for much of his magnificent lyric poetry that subsequently made him famous. He writes a great deal about the birds on the swamplands and the red gum trees, about the sandy flats and the rises, and the grey-green of the yakkas, the heath, and the mint bush, and the baronia, and the banksias. He writes too about the animals, the wild dogs and the kangaroos and emus and the echidnas. These are all part of his story. He has a particular affection for the birds, the apostle birds, the rosellas, the ringnecks, the smoker parrots, the eagles, the wrens. He's very fond of the blue wrens. Nielsen's own knowledge of poetry came from the study of a few books that his father owned, books by Scott and Coleridge. But he said himself that he had the rhymes constantly singing in his head, and he would write these down at night by the light of a slush lamp in the cottage at Dow Well. And the first of them were published in the local Nil newspaper, and then in the Northern Leader, and then finally he broke through to the Sydney Bulletin. Nielsen spent his whole life working in the bush, in Mildura, in the grapes, in the orange fields, on the roads, in the quarries. He was sometimes called the Green Singer because of his fondness of the word green. This came from the fact that he suffered a sight handicap which made it almost impossible for him to write his own poetry. He had to dictate this to his friends, but he found that the light coming through the leaves of the orange trees and the grapevines soothed his eyes and eased the pain there.
Enthusiasm of its many local naturalists, Little Desert is still biologically unassessed. It is only just beginning to attract the attention of ecologists in Melbourne.
The thing that interests me most about the Little Desert is the fact that really it isn't a desert at all. It's an area of great diversity, both botanically and zoologically. And this is part of a system in Victoria which does interest me greatly, because we have this system where it seems the more adverse the environmental conditions, the greater the biological diversity. One can look at the different communities in relation to various environmental parameters such as soils and rainfall and see clearly how different species or different associations of species are defined by these environmental parameters. And the Little Desert has a wide range of these. It's sort of a unique area of vegetation growing on old beach sands under conditions of low rainfall, and so this makes it interesting ecologically. It is a relatively large area of native Australian plant associations. It's surrounded by farmland. It's sort of a discrete entity cut off from the farmlands. It provides a wide range of conditions for scientific study, and it's the sort of area that would be very well suited as a study centre.
And already, for the children of the Wimmera, Little Desert is becoming a living school of ecology.
When I was only 6 miles from the edge of Little Desert, and the school has a block of Little Desert scrub for its own use, and well, it's so untouched and it's so large that it's not widely influenced by outside factors, and we can see, particularly in the plant world, tremendous relationships, soil type relationships to the type of scrub and so on, and anybody with two eyes can see this sort of thing, and yet you read about it and it doesn't make sense. Well, I think ideally you'd want a class to go down one day a week for the whole year, so you can see seasonal changes and trends with rainfall, drought trends and so on. We're lucky to have an untouched tract of land which mercifully has been largely left alone, and we should make the most of it. We should leave it there and use it as a place in which to study the things that we can't study in big cities like Melbourne. We can't study in large developed areas such as the developed Mallee and so on.
In answer to local agitation, some 86,000 acres at the eastern end have now been declared a national park. A further 60,000 acres in the centre may also be reserved for wildlife. The poorer land to the west, which was to be opened up for farming, now remains Crown land. And given that we don't need to increase agricultural production, isn't there a case for leaving Little Desert as it is, part of our heritage?
Well, what excites me is to, some people have their way, in 20 years it'll all be cleared. And the rising generation wouldn't know when it was in a natural state. They'd never know. And I've got to appreciate the amount of different fauna and unique things that's in the scrub. And the more you, I've been in it 50 years, thought I knew everything, but the more you think you know, the less you find out, you know.
Desert featured P.L. Williams, Evelyn Coutts, Alec Hicks, Keith Hately, Claude Austin, Bill Middleton, Les Blake, Clive Crouch, Peter Atterwill, and John Parks. The poems of Shaw Neilson were read by Tim Elliott, and the narrator was Ronald Falk. The Little Desert was arranged and produced by John Chellis.
Re-recorded on the 23rd of March 2023 by Rod Kutch.